previously on Popping Collars.
Google this on YouTube right now, and you should watch just Top Gun Volleyball. Look it up.
I mean, but surely they knew what was... I mean, if they're slow-mowing it's shirtless guys, surely they knew what they were doing.
Is it slow-mo? Or did I slow it down in my brain? It's slow-mo, right?
I'll call it being slow-mo.
It's slow-mo, except Goose is the only one with his shirt still on. And everybody else.
And the song underneath is Running with the Boys.
Yeah,
Running with the Boys.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, that's homoerotic. I don't even know.
And then I'll kick it to you, David, and we'll get started. Welcome to Popping Collars, the podcast that lives in the space between meaning and culture. My name is Greg Knight. I am the Director of Children and Youth Ministries at the Church of Bethesda by the Sea in Palm Beach, Florida. With me is Liz Easton. Hi, Liz. Tell everybody where you are and what you do.
I'm in beautiful Omaha, Nebraska, where spring has sprung today. And I'm the canon to the ordinary for the Diocese of Nebraska.
We also have Ricardo Avila. Ricardo, where are you? What are you up to?
Hi, Greg. Greg, I am the interim rector at St. Luke's Episcopal Church in Long Beach, California.
And we have a very special guest with us this time, Professor David Frankfurter. David, tell us where you are and what it is that you work on.
Well, I'm a professor at Boston University in the religion department, but I live in New Hampshire, where spring has definitely not sprung at all.
It went the other way, I think.
Absolutely. We still have snow on the ground. So I specialize in early Christianity, but I've had a side interest in new religious movements from graduate school, basically. And I've published on the satanic ritual abuse panic, and I've been a media consultant on new religious movements too. So
thank you so much for being with us. This is our 58th episode, and our topic today is just that idea of new religious movements, especially in pop culture. So one of the conceits of our podcast is that people use popular media to make meaning out of the world around them. And there are no shortage of books, movies, television shows about what people call cults or fringe religious beliefs. And it seems, especially when it comes to groups that we don't understand, that we lean on that pop culture to fill in the gaps in our knowledge for good or ill. So we thought that it would be a great idea to get an expert on the topic to join us so that we can see where we may be misled a little bit. So David, I have a question for you to start. What is the difference between what people would identify as a cult versus any mainstream religious system like Judaism, Christianity, Buddhism, etc.?
Well, I would say each one of those mainstream religions has certain intense forms in it. So, you know, Episcopalianism is pretty mainstream, but you had Episcopal charismatics back in the 90s, and you have certain forms of Pentecostal groups. You have the Fred Phelps Church in the Midwest. You have all kinds of let's say extreme forms of Christianity that cater mostly to youth or cater to people who believe the world is about to end. Now, I don't call those cults. I call those apocalyptic movements or youth movements or charismatic movements or something like that. But every religion has these. Buddhism has all kinds of new forms right now, and Judaism just, you know, if you go to Israel, I mean, every person you'll meet is part of a different Hasidic group or drum playing group or something like that. It's wild.
So is the emphasis here on the word new, I guess, like this idea that these belief systems just spawn off kind of new creations naturally, and it's the newness of these things that make them something else, I guess, for those who kind of follow the traditional path of these things.
I mean, I think the newness freaks a lot of people out, especially during the 70s and 80s. You had a lot of new forms of kind of quasi-Asian religions, Rajneesh group, Krishna consciousness again, Unification Church, and that just didn't fit with anyone's idea of what proper religion was. But the other thing that I think freaks people out and gets them calling, labeling religious movements as cults is that they're much more intense than the kinds that you have in a nice mainstream Episcopal or Methodist church or a Reformed synagogue. They involve kids giving themselves completely over to the religious life, or not dropping out of college, separating from their families, all kinds of stuff, which is actually very consistent with scripture if you look at it, but it just doesn't work in a mainstream congregation, you know? So, and with Judaism, it's been really interesting because, people leave these kind of nice mainstream bourgeois reform or conservative congregations, and they hang out with a Hasidic group like Chabad, which you have at all the colleges, and very often, you know, they find it just much more meaningful. You don't just go on Saturday, Friday night and Saturday high holidays. It's like every part of the year is sanctified. Same thing with Christianity. So, I mean, that kind of intensity makes parents and mainstream pastors very uncomfortable, either because it brings into question what they're preaching, or it separates. You know, the kids go off and join their own church and don't do what their parents were expecting of them. Mm.
Yeah. I'm curious, David, because I'm thinking about even times in my life, especially as a young adult, where that type of intensity of religion was really appealing and actually really formative for me, really important. But there seems to be, at least for me as an outsider kind of looking in, this difference between a new religious movement, as you describe some of them, like the Hare Krishnas, for example, or Pentecostal sects, and those expressions where a real tragedy occurs. So I'm thinking of Jonestown, or you know, maybe famously
Heaven's Gate would be one.
Yeah, Heaven's Gate, or even like Charles Manson, which, as far as I know, didn't have a religious bent as we would understand it. But anyway, so a place where people give over so much of their autonomy to a charismatic leader or a set of beliefs or something like that their lives are really at stake.
I'm very interested in charismatic leadership as a phenomenon. I think it's one of the most interesting things we've ever had, we have in the history of religions. And I guess what I'd say is it's extraordinarily dangerous. And yet in every one of these religions, there is a way of understanding charismatic leadership. For example, in the Christian tradition, there is the concept of the prophet, of prophecy. And if prophecy is real, then a person can be a prophet. And it's very complicated to say, oh, that's just a false prophet. In Judaism, there are concepts of religious leaders and inspired teachers. One of the most interesting examples here actually is what was called Waco, the Branch Davidians. Because that was actually the people who joined David Koresh were a sect of a sect of a sect of the Seventh-day Adventists. You would not have joined David Koresh unless you were already inside the Seventh-day Adventist world and understood apocalyptic teachings the way he was talking about them. So here's a religious movement, a part of Christianity that already has an understanding of charismatic leadership. Jonestown, Jim Jones was kind of riffing off Pentecostal African-American preaching, and he also had this kind of Marxist approach too, so he was kind of adding something new in. So on the one hand, charismatic leadership is really interesting and important in religion. On the other hand, it's really dangerous. You're absolutely right.
That idea of charisma, even in our sort of established Episcopal world, can be dangerous on a very small scale. Like, we see congregations where a very charismatic priest passes through for a season and sometimes their charisma is hiding other things or brushing over other important things or not. And then when they move on, the congregation sort of deflates in their absence. And so I'm always a little nervous when I meet those really charismatic clergy, even just in our context.
I feel like I'm on a different page than the rest of you. And I want to yank you all onto my page for a moment here. Right. So I have three things to say. It takes me a while, but then so a little bit following up on what Liz, I think, said, David, I want to know where the line is. I want to know where the line is drawn. Yeah. Like what makes, and we're trying not to use the word cult, but we're saying new religious movements. Without trying to put judgment into a word, like at what point is it like great that people get something out of going to these services and they'll give of their time and their money and their energy? And then at what point does it become coercive? Like, is Mormonism somewhere on that spectrum? David Koresh, you mentioned, was it only considered cultish because they were willing to die for this or were killed? So that I kind of want a line. Like, where do Christian Scientists fall, or are they not even in the discussion? And does Scientology fit in at all? And are there forms of, we're talking about forms of Christianity.
Yeah.
But at what point does it become, if there's a cult of personality rather than a cult of Jesus?
Yeah.
That's direct. What's the answer?
What's the answer?
You know what I'm asking, right?
Yeah, no, I know what you're asking. I mean, let's say we want our kids to be part of our own religion. We don't want them going off and joining some weird group. Okay, so maybe one boundary is that youth are to a large degree doing the same thing that the parents do. And I can say that because it makes us all happy. But we all have been youth, and we know that youth tend to really enjoy very intense forms of religion. And sometimes they join Bible study groups that get very intense. A boundary would be if it's starting to prepare for the end of the world, that's probably a bad sign. I could say that. But on the other hand, you guys know the New Testament. I mean, that whole thing is like, it's oriented towards the end of the world.
Coming. Yeah.
I'm making this arbitrary separation of the Gospel of Mark and the Book of Revelation out and Matthew and Luke in. I'm just saying that, I can make these boundaries, but I know that people on the other side of them have perfectly good arguments about why they're consistent and why they're pure.
I wonder, Ricardo, just thinking about your question, if there's something about the line being drawn at taboo, because I think that some of the things that define these new religious movements are some of the more extreme ones. So Liz mentioned Jonestown. So the taboo that's violated with Jonestown is mass suicide, infanticide, stuff like that. Same thing with Heaven's Gate, mass suicide. When you're talking about things within pop culture, so like Big Love, for instance, HBO show that deals with a form of Mormonism that includes polygamy. That's a social taboo, right? I think that seems to be kind of this idea of taboo seems to be where the line is, I think, for a lot of people on what's on, and this is where it gets really dicey language, on what's on the side of normal and what's on the side of abnormal, you know? And I think that's kind of the code words that we're using with these religious systems is what's a normal religion and what's abnormal religion.
It's an interesting question. And when that kind of thing starts happening, people feel really uncomfortable. The polygamous Mormon, since Mormonism began polygamous, it's part of the tradition, is to have multiple wives. The taboo is our taboo. It may not be a taboo as much in parts of Utah and Colorado.
Sure.
But the LDS makes a point of distancing itself from that history.
Yeah. Right?
Because they know that in order to be accepted in order for those Mormon ads to run on television that I love so much, and always I always put across those Mormon ads every chance I get, they know that they have to put that stuff at as far arm's length as possible, because that's going to identify them as something outside of outside of the norm, outside of a Christian denomination. A
couple of weeks ago, I was in my clericals walking down the street here in Long Beach, and two young Mormon guys, you know, they go out in pairs, et cetera. They were walking towards me, and I was rushing off to go somewhere, and they literally stopped me. So, excuse me, sir, have you – I forget what the question is. Something like, have you encountered Jesus Christ in your life? I'm like, in my clericals. And I said, yeah, I've heard of him, but I've got to go to a meeting right now, you know.
You know, since you guys are talking about popular culture, I want to recommend a movie, a documentary that was made in 1972 called Marjo, M-A-R-J-O-E. And it's about a child minister, a Pentecostal minister, who grows up and does one last tour of the Southwest with a film crew. And he kind of shows all his secrets and talks about what he does. It won an Academy Award back in the 70s. It's a wonderful film that really gives you such a sense of what people want from these charismatic ministers and why they give money as well.
I said it in the introduction, but I really think it's true. Like, wherever we have gaps in knowledge, that's where movies and television and books come in, right? Like, the example that I always use is, I know what an asteroid field is because I saw The Empire Strikes Back. But the thing is, if I were in an asteroid field, actually the chances of me seeing an asteroid is pretty remote, because it turns out that space is pretty big. So like, what I think is an asteroid field is actually not, like, it's nothing like that, right? It's not all like twirling mustaches and evil. It's people trying to figure out how to live their lives, right? And they just get caught up in a system that may work for them, but chances are it may not work for them. And how do they reevaluate their lives when it doesn't work? I think that those are the stories that are the most interesting to me. So when I see things like Scientology and the aftermath that Leah Remini is doing, where she's trying to piece her life back together, having devoted 20 years to this path, like, that's kind of the interesting piece. It's like, are new religious movements sustainable?
You know, we tend to be so scared of charismatic leadership that we think that a person kind of like lands in the group and then they get kind of sucked in and the charismatic leader just kind of manipulates them. But usually what it is you come into a group and you like what other people are doing and you like their friendliness so much and you feel so at home that when a leader comes in and everyone seems to kind of orient it towards him or her, you feel like, wow, this is the kind of the mother or father of the movement, but I like being among the people so much. So we should kind of think of charisma as more of something that's projected onto somebody rather than charisma as something that someone uses as a way of dominating other people.
Well, my question is more like, since you're here and you have a captive audience.
I've got two of those.
These are my favorite kind of episodes because we just pelt you with questions over and over again.
So I have always been a little bit fascinated by the satanic ritual abuse controversy that you mentioned earlier in your introduction. And as we were talking, I realized, and I guess it depends on sort of where you land on these things, but that was a case where the larger public imagined a cult.
Yeah.
So I don't know what, I mean, I guess I don't really have a question, but it's interesting to me that if there's a tension between like the fringe movement or the, you know, whatever it is, the religious expression and the larger mainstream public, there's a natural tension that exists between them, and maybe they feed off of each other in some way. Yeah. In this case, the larger public was seeking an expression and they created it themselves. But there's a popular culture piece of that, I think, with like the Paradise Lost trilogies about the West Memphis Three or about the McMartinville case. And anyway, I just wonder how that whole thing stacks up against the real religious movements that you're talking about.
Well, it was kind of this perfect example, you're right, of a cult that was completely invented. And so whereas, you know, let's say you're a parent looking at the Unification Church and you're thinking charismatic leadership, sexual abuse or overly sexual, brainwashing, crazy ideas, all those kinds of those kinds of things going on. Here with a satanic thing, you had brainwashing, you had something going on in your own neighborhood, so it was kind of a secret conspiracy. You had sexual abuse, and this actually clicked into a whole trend in the, I guess I'd say the 80s and early 90s, when people were just beginning to realize how sexual abuse was rampant and in families. It wasn't something that was just like dirty old men in the streets or something like that. It was actually in families. The idea that there was like an organized religious context for this kind of thing just made so much sense in a culture like ours, where we've been imagining cults from the beginning of time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, from the beginning,
it was like a witch hunt.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, right. Witches are in cults, and you know, one thing after another. We need like a sex cult for every generation, and this was the sex cult for the late 80s and early 90s.
It's like any conspiracy theory, almost, that for whatever reason, it's easier for some people to imagine a very orchestrated, complicated set of circumstances aligning in just the right way for terrible evil to be committed. That's an easier thing to imagine than a member of your own family is sexually assaulting a member of your own family. Like, that is just too hard for people to grapple with. So they make this other, even more complicated thing that somehow seems more believable.
Right, right. And then, of course, to add on to this, you had these people in therapist offices who were saying, this happened to me. And there becomes a kind of secondary gain if you can provide the most lurid description of what your parents did to you. You know, everyone's going to listen. You're going to get on television. You're going to get police investigating you.
So there were no satanic cults.
No,
is that what you were hearing? Really?
Well, listen. There's always been like a Anton LaVey in the Satanic Bible, but they don't. The Satanic Bible doesn't have a whole lot to do with Satan, and the new group that is trying to put up like statues of Baphomet and children, that is like specifically designed to tweak the religious right. I don't think they have a whole lot more identity besides that. So really, there were no satanic cults, exactly.
I remember even sort of recently in my life, I mean, within the last 10 years, a church in a diocese of which I am currently not serving, let me say this, was broken into in the middle of the night and a bunch of sacred objects were stolen. So vestments and, you know, silver and stuff like that. And the message that came out, kind of alerting people about this, was they were probably stolen for black magic rituals.
Mm.
Instead of like, look on eBay. Like that cope is probably on eBay. Like, maybe not. Like, I don't want to, you know, you never know. And I don't know if they had some sort of information that whatever. But it seems wild to me that it can be the first place that people go.
Well, see, the gain for that is that if you have a subversive cult that is stealing it and using it in their rituals, it means it's really valuable.
Right.
And probably within the community, it's just a bunch of very expensive stuff that you need to do liturgy with.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have a satanic cult, which is actually investing it with all that value, then of course, it's that much more valuable.
Mm-hmm.
It's that much more numinous and sacred. So there's that pattern actually goes back to the early modern period in the witch cult, witch hunts, because the way that witch cults would use the host, they would steal the host and they would use it to fly and to do black magic, invested the host with so much extra power in a period when a lot of people were questioning what's the nature of the power of the Eucharist.
So in our conversation that we've had so far, I feel like we've been saying or just agreeing that as human beings, kind of sociologically or anthropologically, we have a need for belief, or we have a need for something in our lives that makes us think there's more out there. But and so we talk about what are these youth of today going to do to fill in that gap when they're not believing in organized religion?
Yeah.
But I don't know if I'm that convinced that, you know, human beings at maybe at this point need to believe in something. I'm actually more inclined to go with what you said, David, that actually what they need is a sense of belonging or a sense of connection or community. That doesn't necessarily have to do with a faith community. That just happens to be how we've organized ourselves for 2,000 years. Do you think there is an innate need in us to have a faith in something? Or can we just get by with, you know, social media communities or groups or Dungeons and Dragon-y groups online? Am I making sense?
Forgive me if I get religious for a moment, but
podcast.
Exactly. But I think that the church speaks to that, and not just in sort of the accidents of our social lives, but in our real belief in the body of Christ. You know, we have a belief in a universal church, which is the body of Christ that lasts forever. And I have a belief, or at least a direct experience in my life, of being completely changed and transformed by a relationship with Jesus as much as a relationship with the people in my faith community. So I still have a lot of hope for the future church, as long as its leaders can be accepting and open to what God is giving us in this moment.
You really should be a member. We got a good thing going on. Stand over there and take a number. We're gonna see if you belong. What about those geeks you hang with? We really don't like their kind. You better get with the program. You don't wanna get left behind.
So, Liz, what do you have to offer us for the benefit of the group?
So my staff pick this week is a book, which I read when I was on vacation, and it's a novel called A Little Life by Hanya Yanagihara. And it came out about a year ago. It's just a brick of a book. It's like 800 pages, which sort of intimidated me at first, but I had this like long travel ahead of me, and I was like, well, I'll get it started. And as it turns out, I couldn't put it down at all. I read the whole 800 pages in 1 week and was just wrecked by it. It was one of those great experiences of reading a book where the characters are so vivid that you feel like you know them. And like, I dreamed about the characters many nights that week, and have heard that others did the same. So it's this just really beautiful story about four young men starting out in New York City right after they graduate from college and kind of beginning their careers, and then being friends with one another for decades. And it's pretty dark. There's a very kind of a strain of the narrative, which is so dark that it's unbelievable.
That book sounds amazing. I've never even heard of it.
It's really, really beautiful. And one of the things that I read was that it was sort of the first try at like an epic mainstream gay novel. And I don't know if the writer would agree with that at all, but it's an interesting lens through which to look at the book. But what really to me was most fascinating was this deep exploration of friendship and the fundamental importance of real friendships in our lives.
You can find Popping Collars on the web at poppingcollarspodcast.com. You can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/poppingcollars. And you can find us on Twitter at Popping Collars. You can also find all of our archived episodes on our website. And our newest episodes are available wherever you get your podcasts, whether that be Stitcher, iTunes, SoundCloud. All we ask is that you subscribe to the show, rate and review. That way folks will be able to find us. And we are featured on EpiscopalCafe.com each and every time. We love the folks at EpiscopalCafe.com. We know you will as well. Check them out for all your Episcopal news needs and beyond. And with that, that is Popping College for this time. Thank you so much. Thank you, Liz. Thank you, Ricardo. And thank you very much, David, for coming on.
Thank you, David. Yeah, that was great, David. Thank you so much.
Yes, absolutely.
When are you going to write a book? When do we read your book?
I have a book. It's called Evil Incarnate, Rumors of Demonic Conspiracy and Satanic Abuse in History.
Wow.
It's like Liz's perfect book.
Yeah, it is. It's like I've been waiting my whole life for that book, David.
It came out in 2006. I think you can get it in paperback.
Awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks.
We will see you next time.
And keep those collars popped.